Okay, our speaker today is Ron Romanello, Property and Casualty Insurance Operations Director and Insurance Software IT Consultant, retired. Ron worked as an insurance operators director for Aetna, the St. Paul, and the Travelers Insurance Companies. He was responsible for policy issuance, billing, office technology, and office administration in the South. He's also a former IBM Insurance Software IT Business Consultant for policy administration systems, billing systems, and overall productivity improvement issues. Ron attended Brigham Young University and is a graduate of the University of Connecticut with a BS degree in industrial administration from the School of Business. His professional certifications include the CIC, Certified Insurance Counselor, CDIA, Certified Document Imaging Architect, and AAM, Associate in Automation Management. Ron was drafted out of high school by the Atlanta Braves as a catcher and played collegiate baseball at Brigham Young University and the University of Connecticut. He's currently associated with Cartabella Gift and Stationery, a family-owned gift and stationery store at the Collection and Coming, owned and operated by his wife and daughter. Ron and his wife Linda have lived in the Atlanta area since 1994 and Coming since 2006, have two children and three grandchildren who also live in Coming. Ron has attended a number of the breakfasts, and it's great to have him be our speaker today. So welcome, Ron Romanello.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Heinz, for putting together just another wonderful breakfast and an opportunity for fellowship in the community. I truly believe that there's something special when a group of men from varied backgrounds and religions and political persuasions can get together, have some breakfast, say a prayer, and end with amen. That's a pretty special thing. I was told that most speakers are supposed to kind of look out and assess the audience, who they're speaking to. That's always been a big part of public speaking. And I want you to know that I've done my assessment. And there's two kinds of people that are here. The first kind is the group that eyeballed the speaker's bio and said that I cannot miss this presentation. I have to be here. I must have this. The second group is the breakfast buffet lover. And so I've taken a gander over here to see that we demolished the breakfast buffet. So my assessment is that you guys are the breakfast buffet lover. So that's where we are for starters here. So I was honored to have this request, and it really is a humbling experience to have to think about this. I've never really been asked to speak about myself. You know, I mean, that's just something that hasn't happened. So, but my first thought were others who preceded me and stood at this podium. Some have reached the top of the corporate pyramid. Others have devoted their lives to us by bravely serving our country and performing admirable, heroic acts. And some have battled serious illnesses and rebounded to tell their stories. And I guess the key word in all of this is stories, because that's what we all have. Our life is filled with stories. And they're all different. They're all unique to us. And I have to confess that I've been very much a taker in all the breakfast that I've attended, and I've taken ideas and thoughts and things from pretty much everybody that I listen to, because so I've been a taker. So today I hope to tell a few stories or two. I'm hesitant to call things lessons that I've learned, but whatever I can share with you, whatever you can take back and share with you, your families, or put to work, that would be great. My first kind of story has to do with professional job opportunities. Most of us follow a traditional event timeline towards their first professional job opportunity, You know, we educate ourselves through high school. We may decide to go to college or a technical school or perhaps the military. And then we seek that perfect professional opportunity. My experience was a little bit different. One Friday night, June 18th, back in 1966 in Torrington, Connecticut, which is home for me, at age 17, I was home with my dad waiting for the Friday night fights to begin. Oh, I love those Friday night fights. I was watching the Gillette shaving commercials. You guys probably remember it, right? Look sharp, feel sharp, be sharp, right? The old Gillette commercials. So while we were waiting, the phone rang, and I jumped up to answer the phone, and I thought it was one of my buddies who was able to secure his dad's car for the evening, you know, and I was kind of ready to go out, but it wasn't. It was Western Union with a telegram. I didn't know who Western Union really was, but I'll read you the telegram. It says, "It's with considerable pleasure that I advise you that the Atlanta Braves have secured the rights to negotiate a professional baseball contract with you. My entire staff will consider it a privilege and a duty to do everything possible to prepare you to become a future major league ball player. If he has not already done so, you can look forward to our authorized representative in the area contacting you soon. Looking forward to meeting you personally. Good luck, John McHale, president of the Atlanta Braves." So I was a catcher in Torrington High School, age 17. That was pretty special. This particular draft coincided with the Braves moving to Atlanta from Milwaukee, so they hadn't been here really long. It also was the second ever Major League Baseball draft. No TV, no radio, not a lot of fanfare. For me, it was just a quiet, you know, exciting experience. I really didn't know about the draft, to be honest with you. It was Friday night, and I was going to watch the fights. And so at the end of the reading of the Western Union, I said thank you and hung up. I mean, I didn't know what to say, you know. I didn't know the person at the other end, and then the following day, the telegram was actually delivered to my home. But becoming a professional athlete was a goal. It wasn't an accident. It was the result of a lot of hard work between the ages of 12 and 17. My father just one day said, you know, how would you like to do this? How would you like to be a baseball player? He could have said a truck driver. He could have said anything. And, you know, I just hadn't given any thought to anything, and I probably would have just said, yeah, that's great. But I did say it was great, and we continued to watch ball games and so forth. And I had an uncle who, with a bunch of people, bought some farmland that they had a plan to turn into a golf course. And that never materialized, and for years they struggled with all of this property to try to sell it. They put homes on it, you know, over the years. But in any event, there was a field, and so my dad and I took over the field, and we actually made a baseball field. And this was long before the movie Field of Dreams, I have to tell you. Long before that, I swear we had, this was the original Field of Dreams. And so, you know, he bought a pickup truck, we bought equipment, and we built this baseball field. And we were there constantly. Now it's Connecticut, so you know this is a very seasonal thing. He pitched until his arm was sore. And then my uncle showed up, and he pitched with his other arm, right-hander and a left-hander, until his arm was sore. And this was repeated day after day, week after week, month after month. And to get to a point. Now, fortunately, my dad and my uncle knew a lot about the game and were very good themselves, so I was being taught, you know, the right way. So we did this. There was certainly a lot of family bonding. But the other thing, how did this whole idea come about? It came about through the Kansas City Royals. The Kansas City Royals were conducting an experiment, and their experiment was, can the organization create baseball players, okay, just by taking people that had certain skills, skills that can't be taught, okay, maybe running fast or a strong arm or something, okay, unique eyesight, right, to see a ball, and give them an experience and teach them things that you can, skills that you can learn, how to throw a curveball, how to do something else that was really special. So they were conducting this experiment, and I think that's what my dad picked up on, because I was not a natural at this. I told you, we did things day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year, as it turned out, and to get to a point. And so I think the Royals found that experiment, you know, could work, but it takes a long time because you're trying to teach some things that are maybe should be instinctive and were not. So they abandoned their program after years, but they did have some success, and it was an expensive proposition. But certainly in our experience as a family, it worked. And so so that's one of the things that we'll kind of recap at the end, you know, about trying some new things and trying to do some things different and better. I've always had support from my parents along the way in all of this. My father fortunately knew the game. He was not only able to get me to the next level, but several levels up, which I'm certainly eternally grateful. My mother, she never missed a game. She would stay up late, clean uniforms. I never, ever, ever played with a dirty uniform, ever. And she always would say something to me, mostly because she would observe things in the stands that I wouldn't see down in the field, you know, like as I look back on it, like who might be in the audience. So she always said to do your best because you never know who's watching. And so, she would tell me that like over and over, just like my dad would be throwing pitches to me. I mean, she would just say, you just never know. Always do your best, you know, don't throw the ball like this, you know, throw it like this. Never, you know, do things halfway. You never know who's watching. Well, I did get that visit from the scouts after the telegram came. And so we had this, between the bonus and 4 years, they were going to pay for 4 years of college. It was a $30,000 to $40,000 deal back in 1966, which I thought was pretty good. It also included the $1 contract with the Topps baseball card people. So their contract is for $1. It's still $1 today. They pay $1 to get the rights to take your picture and put it on a card. And they told me I was going to be going to West Palm Beach, Florida, to play for the Braves down there. I was really happy with that because that was not the rookie league. That was regular Class A baseball at the time. So I was 17 years old. This opportunity presented itself at that age, and my dream was coming true. So I thought it was coming true, but my dad and my uncles decided for me. I couldn't sign my contract at 17, but this was in the middle of the Vietnam War, okay? And the only deferments you would get was to go to college. If I tried to go play baseball, I wouldn't have been able to do that. The Selective Service would raise your name to the top of the list, and so it's kind of like your life now is in somebody else's hands. When I said my dad and my uncles, my dad came from a large family, and in World War II, four of the five sons were serving at the same time. Three overseas in the war, one stayed, was able to stay back, but all four were there. So they understood a little bit about what war was all about, and they really didn't want me to go, certainly not at that age. So so this happy experience of being drafted was turned into a major disappointment at the time. Although the Braves had a year to try to negotiate a contract, that's a typical thing. So now I had to find my way off to college, and I hadn't settled on all of that as yet. So I remembered that year Brigham Young University won the national NCAA basketball tournament. So I had their name right on the tip of my tongue, and I researched the school a little bit, and they played a lot of the big time. West Coast, and they played in the Western Athletic Conference at the time. They also played, you know, UCLA, University of Southern California, a lot of the big name baseball kinds of schools. So there I was, an Italian Catholic boy, having to go to see my parish priest to write a letter of recommendation to go to the Mormon school. So it worked out pretty good, you know. I mean, they all kind of worked together, and but it worked out, and so I was off to school, and they didn't allow freshmen back then to play, and this is kind of a national thing, varsity sports at the time. They were just getting ready to do that. So there was a freshman program, there was a varsity program. And so I, you know, got involved in that. Less than 10 months while I was out at school, less than 10 months after being drafted and having to say no to the contract at the time, my cousin, at age 19, was killed in Vietnam. He was the first from our town. So I wear this bracelet to remember him. And this could be passed to my son in time. But he was my hero. So this was devastating to the family, obviously. And I felt the need to come back to Connecticut. And so I transferred to the University of Connecticut. And when you transfer from Division I to Division I, you have to sit out a year. So I sat out my year and spent my time swinging the bat out in center field while everybody else was playing the game. But that summer, after the next school year, I went to play baseball in the Cape Cod League, which I don't know if anybody knows anything about the Cape Cod League, but it's the premier college place to play in the summertime. You go there, you get a job. I worked on a cranberry bog, cut grass all around the cranberry bog. They gave me a truck and a tractor, and I was off seeing some of the most beautiful off-road places that New England had had to offer. So again, wooden bats, lots of scouts, lots of visibility, and it was kind of the equivalent of playing like double-A baseball. Everybody was an all-star of some sort. You were always seeing the best pitchers, and everybody was always showing the best that they had. So I was hitting really well. I was hitting over 300. My catching was good. But one night, I got in a really bad collision at home plate. And the next morning, I woke up with facial paralysis. And the doctors locally said I had Bell's palsy. And some of you might know about Bell's palsy. So there I was, my face was drooping, my eye was drooping. I didn't know at the time what it was, and it was a pretty scary, you know, kind of thing. So I went back to Connecticut for some medical treatment, got the diagnosis made and, you know, what it was. Although it wasn't there long, and I went back to Cape Cod, but I still had pretty heavy residual effects from the Bell's palsy. My batting average fell, and so I really seemed to have lost something with eyesight or reaction time. Something happened, although my catching was not impacted in any way by this. I was the All-Yankee Conference catcher, and as the year went on after the Cape Cod League, and I continued to play. But Uncle Sam and the Selective Service folks still had my name, and they weren't done with me just yet. But so I got my draft notice while I was in school, and so I went down to New Haven for my physical. And the doctor said, because he saw the Bell's palsy, he could see it, and he says, "Well, what can't you do?" I said, "Well, I can't wink, and I can't whistle, and I can't blow up a balloon." And quite surprisingly, he gave me a medical deferment. And I said, "Well, why was that?" Because inside I was prepared, right, to go, as most people are that make it down to these centers. He said, "Well," he says, "we really don't know whether you had, because of the collision, truly had Bell's palsy, which is a a viral kind of, it's like a virus, an infection, or if you had some other, some nerve damage because of the collision." So they didn't want to take any chances with that. So so there I go, back to University of Connecticut, where one day in the dugout was the scout, again, from the Atlanta Braves. Because he knew I was going to be getting out of school, they still had some interest. So there I was in the dugout with him for a little meeting, and so he talked, and I'm there, my mouth is drooping, my eye is down, I'm trying to talk, and I am sure that while we're having this conversation, I am spitting all over this guy. Okay, I mean, that's just the way it was, you know. So I was pretty much damaged goods, because then he didn't know whether it was Bell's palsy or, you know, the other medical possibility. Anyway, that was the kind of the end of the baseball kind of thing. It was an unfulfilled dream with a lot of interesting pieces and moving parts to it. I did go on and start, you know, life's work, working for Aetna, and doing the marriage thing and the family, you know, and all of that has worked out extremely well. In my work life, they told me you needed it was strongly recommended you have some kind of professional designation. So much like the baseball thing, I pursued this CIC designation, Certified Insurance Counselor. Now, I was never an underwriter, always worked in the back room kind of thing, okay? So I wasn't on the front end, sales or anything like that. So insurance, you know, the policy itself, the words, the contract and all of that was not something that I grew up with or was even trained, but I had to immerse myself in it just like I did with the baseball thing. So it was very, very difficult for me, but I finally got the designation after many, many attempts. Taking the professional exam, by the way. But in any event, I kind of linked that back to the baseball thing about, you know, you can do anything if you really try. I started doing some other things. I umpired college baseball. And after, of course, working my time doing high school baseball, I had a chance and I umpired at Fenway Park, which was pretty cool. I did a college all-star game that's done there every year just before the year's baseball draft. And so I did that, and I was we had four umpires, and I was the second base umpire. So second base umpire traveled the outfield quite a bit, right? Every time there's a fly ball, you have to go out. And there were a lot of fly balls, and I spent a lot of time out near the Green Monster. And, you know, they had to call me to come back in, you know, sometimes, because you just kind of get into the place. My indicator for balls and strikes, it didn't work. You know, it took several innings for it to work. And interestingly, I met a major league baseball player in the area. He's still here, very successful with the Oakland A's, a pitcher named Dave Beard. And Dave owned a office supply or office furniture store down on Mantell Road. And so I told Dave, you know, that I did that, had that experience up at Fenway Park. He went, "Whoa!" He goes, "No, we all heard that baseball players are superstitious, right?" He said, "There's ghosts there." He goes, "There are ghosts." I said, "What do you mean?" He says, "Well," he said, "you know, if you really get out there and you think about all of the people that played on this field, the same field that you're on now, he goes, the ghost will come and screw you up. That's why your indicator wasn't working, you know, for five innings, you know. And you know something, he was absolutely right, because that's exactly what, you know, you think about all the people that were there, you know, not just last week or who was going to be there tomorrow, but, you know, certainly the many years past, you know, the Ted Williams of the world and even the Babe Ruths of the world, you know, that passed through those gates and went on the field. So it was pretty cool. I want to tell you one other story. I also became the president of the baseball umpires group in the area. And we're not going to talk about rules and things like that, but one of the standing agenda items was a report from the trainer of the new umpires. And we look forward to that report every meeting. And so at this first meeting, he gave up to give his report. And he says, well, we got this one guy. He's having a lot of problems, you know, with his getting to be an umpire. He says, well, what's the problem? He says, well, he's letting the people get to him. He's listening to all the chatter from the parents and everything in the stands, you know. He's having a lot of problems with this. So I said, well, you know, we gave him some encouragement and sent him on his way. So, okay, that's all we can do. So the next meeting, time for his report again. And he said, we're still having more problems with this umpire. You know, he's listening to everybody. They're telling him that, you know, it's the usual stuff. He goes, you know, get your glasses, punch holes in the mask, you know, all of those things, you know, that, you know, maybe you guys have hollered some of this stuff yourself. I don't know. I see some guilty faces out here. And I said, well, give him some encouragement. You know, he'll be okay. We all go through this. And so the next meeting came, and he gave his report, and he said that the umpire quit. I said, what happened? He says, Ron, he says, frankly, he says, he had to quit. He goes, because he heard something come out of the stands that even I haven't heard. He says, it was devastating. He said, what was that? He said, ump. Parents stood up. Ump, you must have been a lookout at Pearl Harbor. He quit. That was, I had never heard that one before. I said, I don't know where that, but it was true. So he quit and then took up some other kind of little hobby or special interest. Our family relocated, as we got south here, relocated in the insurance business. I was with Aetna, and we went to Louisiana. Anybody from Louisiana? Spent any time in Louisiana? So they described it as like leaving the country without all the fuss. They even took American money. So I had a wonderful experience in Louisiana. I was only there a couple years in the New Orleans area, moved to Jackson, Mississippi, and then here. And then after a lot of mergers and acquisitions and lost jobs, okay, because of all of that, I went to the technology side of the house and was fortunate to work as a consultant, business consultant with IBM. And matter of fact, I just had my last consulting assignment about a year ago now, and but now, I am kind of immersed in our family business up at the collection, just up the street here a little ways. My wife and daughter own a store called Cartabella. It's a gift and stationery store, mostly gift, about 95% gift. So it's a place where you guys can go and get points with your ladies and granddaughters and daughters and whatever. And so I do look forward to seeing your credit card. So thank you for that. Anyway, I'm working on, personally, on some bucket list items now. I've always had a fascination for driving large vehicles, so I decided to drive a school bus with Forsyth County, so I'm doing trips now, so I get a chance to see some sports and things that I have never seen before, like men's lacrosse, you know, and that's quite an interesting game. So I sat through my first lacrosse game this year, and I really thoroughly enjoyed it. I'm also then, I said, well, that big bus was okay, but I want to go to the bigger bus. So I'm also driving the big motor coaches for Daniel's Charters, if you see any of their buses around. So that gets me different places. I was at, saw my first NASCAR event. I was down at Talladega a couple of weeks ago and got into the motor racing. Boy, that's pretty cool. I see all the partying that goes on around there. It makes an NFL tailgate thing look like a church picnic, I'll tell you. It's just a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful thing. So anyway, I'll leave you today with three or four things that I'll just call them takeaways. You can do with them whatever you want. But the first one is that what I learned in my little baseball story is that you can learn anything if you just immerse yourself in it. And so I would encourage you to pass that along to people in your household, maybe even yourselves, you know. Become exceptional at something, okay? It doesn't have to be major. For instance, if your cell phone is a problem to you, you don't know how to use it, you don't know all the features in it, just spend some time with it, okay? And become a master of your cell phone as something to start, but learn to use more of its features. And that's just kind of like the Kansas City Royals experience, right? If you just devote your time to this, I'm sure you can learn how to play music if you put your mind to it and had the time. But so something like that. And similar to that was my work in trying to get the professional designation. I really didn't want to do it. I kind of had to do it. But the only way to do it was to make a commitment to it and just get it done. And it worked out fine. The second item is play your best, okay? My mom said, right, you don't know who's watching you, so always do that. And it's kind of interesting. People are always watching you is the moral of that story. And interestingly, in some of my bus pursuits and training that goes along with that, and there is a fair amount of it, more than what I anticipated or thought, one of the trainers came out with the phrase, they said, always be seen doing the right thing. And I liken that to, you never know who's watching you. So and so it was kind of a repeat and a throwback to some things that I learned as a child. So, you know, always be seen doing the right thing. Look sharp, feel sharp, be sharp, like the commercial says. Opportunities. Okay, I had an opportunity, and I didn't get a chance to take advantage of it. And, you know, it still bothers me today, without a doubt. It still bothers me today that I just don't know what would have happened. So I mentioned a year ago that I did my last consulting assignment. And it's interesting that I thought all the way back to the baseball thing, when the phone rang and the emails came in about that assignment, I said, no, I'm going to take it. So I stopped what I was doing in order to do this thing because I didn't want to have another episode of always wondering, you know, what could have, would have kind of thing, you know, happen, you know, if I didn't take the assignment. So I took the assignment. It turned out to be just a four-month kind of a thing, but I feel good that I evaluated, took advantage of the opportunity. So pass that along to your kids and family also. And really the last thing is to teach your children and your grandchildren, have a discussion about the meaning of Memorial Day. That's right around the corner. Don't count on the schools because it's not happening there. And I think John mentioned that in his little talk today. I had a chance in his early, early coaching career at the University of Connecticut to meet Jimmy Valvano, and of course we all know Jimmy from his speech, you know, where he says never ever give up, right? That's his speech. And so the Memorial Day thing is one where, you know, I say never forget, never ever, you know, forget. So have that conversation with your family, and because we're missing that history piece. We had a little conversation about missing the history, and the kids today are not learning what Memorial Day is all about. They're not learning a lot about our country and what goes on and what made it, how we got to this point. And they don't know how to take it beyond. And so it's a pretty sad kind of thing. So it's really up to us to do this. So this year, have a very special Memorial Day and a year, and never forget those who died for us. Thank you all very much. I enjoyed chatting. If you have any questions, I'm here. We can talk. I'm so happy I didn't talk about insurance, though, today. But thank you. Thank you very much.
Got it. Thank you. Great job, Ron. I always love to hear stories like Ron has shared, and you know, it's really a good exercise for yourself. I'm sure, as Ron, as you were going through this, some of these things reminded you of the richness of your life and family, and some of the things that sometimes we don't think about as much when we get involved in the day-to-day routine of things. And just a great story, and it's trying to communicate what we know or we've experienced to others. We were talking about that today, that it's harder and harder because of the generation gap and the huge differences between the economic conditions when some of us were growing up and the economic conditions today, to communicate some of the values and some of the things that we went through to the youth of the day, who are the leaders of the day. And I think it starts by encouragement, not criticism. You know, just being, extending the richness of life that we've had somehow to others, to demonstrate the impact of that when you do reach a mature age. We're, none of us are old, but we're more mature here. So thank you again, Ron, for sharing that. If you have some questions of Ron, please ask him. And we'll have the next one in August. I think it's August 15th. So I hope to see you then, and appreciate you all coming. Have a great day. Thank you.